From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Ellen Sachs is a winner. She graduated first in her class at Vanderbilt and went on to Oxford, Yale Law School, and tenure at USC. She also hears voices, has paranoid delusions, and knows all too well how it feels to be strapped down in a psych ward. Ellen Sachs has schizophrenia. So do 2.4 million other Americans. Now she's speaking publicly about her private battle. This hour on Point, the scholar and schizophrenia. Joining me today from Los Angeles is Ellen Sachs. She is the Orrin B. Evans Professor of Law, Psychology, Psychiatry, and the Behavioral Sciences at the University of Southern California Gould Law School. She is also an adjunct professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. She writes about her battle with schizophrenia in the new memoir, The Center Cannot Hold, My Journey Through Madness. Ellen Sachs, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's very nice to be here, Tom. Thanks.
You're 50, 51, something like that. You've got a lot of life and accomplishment under your belt at this point. What moved you to dive back in and tell the whole world this story that you spent a lot of your life hiding?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of stigma attached to mental illness and maybe even particular schizophrenia. So the idea of being public, of, quote, coming out, I spent a lot of time thinking about should I do it, and if I should do it, when should I do it. And I decided I should do it. I decided that there need to be more people who have schizophrenia who speak publicly about their struggles and put a human face to the disorder. It helped that I had a lot of professional security in my job and had a decent reputation professionally and so on, so that the risks weren't as high as they might have been earlier in my career. But notwithstanding that there was a risk in doing the book, I thought that I really, really needed to do it. My goals were really, as I say in the book, to give hope to those who suffer from schizophrenia and understanding to those who don't.
Well, we're grateful that you're stepping up and speaking out. It's been fairly rare on this front, though in recent years, you know, we've heard from depressives, even people with suicidal depression have come out and talked about it, whether it's Mike Wallace and Jane Pauley, William Styron, and we all know the historical figures in that camp, you know, Lincoln and Van Gogh and Virginia Woolf and Samuel Johnson. Why so much more rare, it seems, from the schizophrenic quarter? These are often very voluble, very intelligent people.
One of the problems is that sometimes or often with schizophrenia, patients not only have symptoms like delusions and hallucinations, but what we call negative symptoms like apathy and withdrawal. So they lose motivation and they don't live up to their potential that they had before they became ill. My own view is I'm an example of someone who resources were put into who ended up having a very good life. And I think two things need to be done with other people with schizophrenia. One, put more resources in so they can live up to their potential. And two, don't discourage them for trying to achieve a lot. I'm getting a lot of phone calls and emails from people as a result of my book, The Center Cannot Hold. And I'm reminded of one person in particular who spoke to me on the phone and said, you know, my doctor says lower your expectations, don't try, but I want to try. I want to make something of my life. So, the myth that people with schizophrenia can't work may lead some professionals, mental health professionals, to discourage people from really trying. And that's too bad because work gives most people a sense of self-esteem and productivity and focus.
Ellen Sachs, Professor Sachs, you're so accomplished, so well-spoken. It's easy as we listen to you to kind of forget or gloss over or make light of what you've been through on the mental health front. I wish you'd begin to give us a sense of it. I mean, take us back. Tell us your story. How did you begin to become aware that schizophrenia might be part of your life? And, I mean, I know from the memoir this has been no cakewalk. Give us some sense of that.
I guess as a child I had, you know, your typical neurotic polysymptomatic picture with phobias and obsessions and so on. Two things a little bit more alarming. One, I had periods of disorganization, which feels like your mind is kind of falling apart like a sandcastle with the sand sliding away in the receding surf. You can't really take things in and put them together. And then the second thing was I had a kind of frank psychotic episode walking home from school one day. The houses got all weird and ominous and started, I thought, sending me messages.
How old were you?
I was about 16.
And the houses were weird, meaning what? They looked, they had some Halloween faces on? Or
yeah,
just,
well, nothing
that. Not that literal.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Just kind of an ominous, brooding kind of presence. And then sending me messages, not voices, but thoughts I knew were being placed in my mind. You are evil. You are bad. You are especially bad. Look, you must see. You know, kind of weird stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then, you know, in college, I had a few episodes of disarray, and I had very bad personal hygiene my first year, but did not really, quote, officially break down until I went to Oxford as a Marshall Scholar when I was 21.
So this will be just after your undergraduate years. You went to England. It's a lovely. It's an honor to have this scholarship. And what happened
there? I just fell apart. I started getting very depressed. I lost a lot of weight. I had mild paranoid ideation that people were laughing at me and talking about me behind my back. I thought that I wasn't supposed to speak because I thought that would spread my evil around. And of course, if you don't speak, it's hard to make friends. And I also had very vivid and intense and scary suicidal ideation, you know, kind of pouring gasoline over myself and lighting a fire and so on. And I sought treatment and was treated in a hospital for 1 month the first year and 4 months the second year. Again, my illness looked like depression with psychotic symptoms at first, mm-hmm. but over time it developed more into a pure thought disorder or psychotic disorder where I had lots of hallucinations and delusions. But I got into psychoanalytic treatment, and that seemed to interrupt the malignant negative symptoms. But I still had a lot of crazy ideas, like I thought I was killing hundreds of thousands of people with my thoughts, and that little men were getting in my brain and setting off nuclear explosions, and my speech often got garbled and unintelligible. As an example, I describe a breakdown on the roof of the Yale Law School where mm-hmm. we were doing a memo on, and I said, you know, are
you and
my
several
cases,
classmates had been doing a late classmates. Night study session, and suddenly
yeah.
you're out on the roof.
I'm out on the roof singing jingles and twirling around and saying things like, you know, have your cases been infiltrated? We've got to case the joint. I don't believe in joints, but they do hold your body together. So words mm-hmm. that are phrases that are loosely associated but don't really make sense. So for me, that's how schizophrenia looks, delusions. I have some hallucinations, not very much and not at all for a long time. And then the disorganized thinking.
You know, Ellen, so we'll have some listeners who may know this intimately and only too well, and others with no experience of it. And so when I want to just ask, when you talk about these sensations of voices or nuclear explosions going off in your mind, or how literal do these things seem? Is it all kind of metaphor, or, you know?
Well, it's a range. So at the, actually, my husband put it, psychosis is not an on-off switch. It's a dimmer. So there's degrees. And on one end of the spectrum, you'll have a thought like that and you'll say – and I'll say, oh, that's just my illness acting up. Pay no mind, you know,
right,
something
right.
like that. But there's, again, a continuum. At a little bit of a later stage, I will be like, well, I this seems right to me. I mean, I think it has to be right. But I know other people won't believe it, so I won't say it. Two, I'm totally convinced this is right, and I'm crouching in a corner, shivering, shaking, and scared out of my wits.
You met the American psychiatric treatment system. It wasn't quite as gentle as the British one. In fact, it was rough, and you developed a kind of lifelong campaign mentality against restraints. You were restrained. You were belted down.
I was restrained for long periods of time, 15 hours, 20 hours for the first few days I was hospitalized in America. And then for about 3 weeks, I probably was restrained anywhere from 2 to 5 hours a day.
Because they feared you would hurt yourself or others.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I have to tell you, it's the most degrading, humiliating, painful. After about 10 or 15 hours, it's enormously painful just mm-hmm. not being able to move at all. And I actually wrote my first law article, my student note on mechanical restraints, and learned, or what I had suspected, that restraints hadn't been used for 200 years in England. And indeed, I just went back there. My British publisher flew me and my husband back there, and I met with my old doctor from 30 years ago and asked him if that's still true. And he said, yeah, it's still true. We largely don't use restraints. But, you know, doctors justify using them by saying it makes patients feel safer. But when you talk to patients, they have a kind of different view. And when you read surveys of patients ranking emergency measures, restraints are always last. The doctors also say they keep people safe, but there's a study done by a Harvard statistician for the Hartford Courant who estimates that about 150 to 150 restraint deaths a year happen. Someone will have a heart attack or aspirate their vomit or get strangled themselves. Something that's supposed to keep people safe is killing people. So I would totally revamp rules regarding restraints and, you know, make it so that it gets closer to England than to where we are today. It's better than when I was a patient, but it's still not good enough.
We'll look more at that issue. I guess I feel like I have to say, I mean, you sound so together, so well-spoken. Your record of accomplishment is so clear, and yet it's important for people to understand you're not free of this. This is still a real issue in your life. You have medication to help handle this. You have, as I understand, daily talk therapy to handle this.
I see a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst 5 days a week, and I see my psychopharmacologist every other week, and I have a huge amount of support and help to, you know, let me do this. And again, I think, you know, if we can replicate some of what I get, you know, and help other people live up to their potential, that'd be good. Although I will say, you know, people say, oh, you're unique. You know, your story can't tell us anything. But I'm doing a study with UCLA and USC professors about high-functioning people. And we're out there. We have a doctor. We have a clinical psychologist. We have advocates.
Talking this hour about a life of schizophrenia, an extraordinary life. Ellen Sachs is a top-flight law professor, and Ellen Sachs is schizophrenic. She's sharing a look into her life and mind, looking with us at what she calls madness. Her new memoir is The Center Cannot Hold, My Journey Through Madness. And Ellen, there are a lot of people who want to speak with you. Julie's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Julie, you're on the air.
Yes, my name is Julie Green. I have schizoaffective disorder. I'm also studying for my Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing at Goddard College.
Good for you.
Cool.
My thesis is about my mental illness and what it means to be mental ill right now. And a piece that did not make it into my thesis is about the term consumers. And how I don't like it, and it is a euphemism for something that, in being a euphemism, it assumes that the term mental illness and mental patient are ugly terms, and I dislike the term, and I think
You dislike the term consumer? Is it somehow related?
Consumer is used. People say, oh, you know, It's a term that people use for people who are mentally ill.
Consumer?
Yeah, that's the kind of PC term. Actually, it's kind of interesting. In England, they use the term user.
Are we talking about in terms of medication, a consumer of medicine? I never made that connection.
Consumer is the word that people use today for people who are psychiatric patients. It's the kind of...
Okay, I see. So this is the consumer of services, of mental health services.
Exactly. Right.
As opposed to what would you suggest, Julie?
I would suggest using the term person with mental illness or person who has a mental illness or... Mental patient.
Let me ask about a couple of things then. One is language, and the other, just before that even, Ellen, Julie's on the line. Here we are. Julie says, look, I've got schizophrenia issues. Ellen Sachs, you're putting yours right out there. Does that give you a feeling of a bond or not?
For me, yeah. When people, you know, in the community reach out, either by calling shows like this or sending me emails or calling me, I do feel a connection. I mean, sort of interesting, even speaking with journalists and radio hosts and so on in the course of my book stuff, it's surprising how many people will open up and say, you know, nobody at work knows and only my closest friends know, but I've been bipolar for 30 years. You know, so this is a media person disclosing that. It makes me feel good on a number of levels. First, that people feel comfortable enough that they can actually talk about it and say it out loud. And second, a sense of camaraderie or a bond. Here's a person who knows better than most what this is like.
And when you hear Julie call in and begin to share a tiny bit of her story with us, are you listening with a different kind of ear? Are you hearing some kind of background music there that a naive ear might not?
I'm not really sure. I don't think so, especially. Yeah.
What about language? I mean, she's concerned even about patients being called consumers of mental health services or anything else. What about the whole range? I mean, you use madness, right, in your book title.
Right.
You just threw out bipolar. I don't know how that exactly relates to schizophrenia, synonym or something else. What's the realm of language around this that you pay attention to?
Well, just to let you know, bipolar is a mood disorder. It used to be called manic depression.
Right.
And schizophrenia is a thought disorder or a psychotic disorder. You know, I kind of share with Julie the view that consumer is not the right word. I don't like it. But on the other hand, so many people do like it, and I think we should call people by whatever they want to be called by, right?
What about madness? You put it in your title. Are you happy to be called mad? It's pretty close to crazy in our ordinary lexicon. I was a little surprised that you use it, but you do. Maybe it's a don't shy away from it posture.
Yeah, I think that is what it is. Yeah, I'm not offended by being called mad or having a mental illness or being called the mentally ill as opposed to people with mental illness. I mean, I guess there is some virtue to trying to suggest by saying people with mental illness instead of mentally ill. If you just call someone the mentally ill, that kind of suggests that defines them. Whereas if you say a person with mental illness, you're talking about a person who has this condition. So I guess I prefer that.
But when you go to madness, you're well beyond those nuances. I mean,
right.
Part of – are you suggesting that we try to regularize our interactions with the mentally ill, or for that matter, the mad? Can that be done? Is it a reasonable target for a culture that's tried to regularize its interactions with all kinds of people once ostracized?
Well, yeah. I mean, and in a sense, people say things about mentally ill people that they wouldn't dream of saying similar things about minorities or ethnically diverse people, right? You know, oh, he's crazy. She's a kookaburra. She's off the wall. They should go to a loony bin. I mean, at a certain point, it becomes offensive and painful. And I think having stigma busters pointing out to people when they're saying those things is a good thing. On the other hand, I don't know. I feel like I can say it because I'm a sufferer, and I don't think part of me thinks we shouldn't be that sensitive to nuances of language.
Julie, thank you for your call. We got a call from Michael in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
Well, the first thing I want to do is to compliment Ellen Sachs, give a standing ovation to Ellen Sachs for this very important work that you're doing and doing it in such an articulate way. My mother was diagnosed with schizophrenia when I was 5 and lived and struggled with it all her life. And we in the family pretty much kept it to ourselves until about 12 years ago. I worked as a performing artist. About 12 years ago, I started touring with a one-man play called Hearing Voices, Speaking in Tongues, and it's about my mother's life and the life of our family.
Wow.
And
did you run it? Did you write it, Michael?
Hmm?
Did you write the book, the play, or?
Yes.
Oh, wow, cool.
It often runs in families. Did you grow up with the fear that it would be part of your life as well, or is it, Michael?
Absolutely did. Me and my brother and my two sisters, it was a cloud that was hanging over all of our lives.
Right.
And I'm pleased to say we're out of the window of opportunity.
Right.
Schizophrenia typical onset is late teens to late 20s in that window. So we're beyond that now.
And let us just ask you, since you perform right on this issue, this message all the time, what's your sense of how people, Americans, respond to the fact of schizophrenia these days?
Well, the way I see it is there have been a couple of great leaps forward. In the 1980s, with the advent of family support groups such as the National Alliance on Mental Illness, when families were getting together and talking openly for the first time about the lives of their loved ones and about their own lives and struggles, and it really helped to raise public awareness to an unprecedented degree. And it seems to me that we're now in the middle of a second great leap forward, and Ellen is very much a part of that. This leap is where people with schizophrenia, with mental illness themselves, are coming out and saying, well, this is it. This is the fact of my life. I didn't ask for it, but I've got it, and this is the deal. I'm speaking my truth. And I think that it's really making public awareness around mental illness, it's taken it really to the next level.
Michael, thanks very much
for
that. Ellen, do you feel it that way with your colleagues? I mean, you were closeted, quasi-closeted until very recently. Now you've sort of stood up. Right. Is it working? Do people now look into your eyes in a different way? Do you sense them trying to gauge whether or not you've got some, you know, odd thing going on in there or not?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's one of the risks, and it happens a little bit. I remember I was visiting my family, and I kind of sighed, and immediately my dad said, "What's wrong?" You know. So there's a little bit of over concern, or people thinking that while they're talking to me, I'm having symptoms. Are they having? Am I having symptoms? What should they do?
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, people have been enormously supportive and encouraging and kind. I had one person, an administrator, say to me that she's glad she had started going out to dinner with me before she heard I was mentally ill. And I said, why? And she said, well, because I never would have gone to dinner with you, mm-hmm. which was kind of shocking. But I felt glad that she felt comfortable enough to say that. And it just underscores how bad stigma is.
I want to bring into our conversation, if I may, an old friend of yours, one you know very well and still are close with, Dr. Stephen Behnke joins us from Washington today. He's a clinical psychologist and attorney. You and he met in 1983, I think, when you were students
yep.
at Yale Law School, friends ever since. He's director of ethics in the American Psychological Association, teaches in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, has worked with schizophrenics in a day treatment program, group home settings, knows you very, very well, Ellen Sachs. Stephen Behnke, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on your show, Tom.
Hey, Steve.
Hello, Ellen.
There are, light hellos from each of you, but this is a relationship with a lot of weight to it that goes way, way back. Stephen Behnke, can you just take us back to remind us how you first came to know Ellen, this side of Ellen, the fact of her schizophrenia?
Well, Ellen and I were in law school together in New Haven at Yale, and we were in a class that we shared. And I got to know Ellen because she, first of all, struck me as very, very smart and very thoughtful. And one evening after dinner, we ended up at the same table and just had a very long conversation well into the evening and about our lives and our thoughts and our reasons for coming to law school and our thoughts about what we might do after. And it was very shortly after that that we spent a long afternoon at one of our favorite little pizzerias in New Haven. And in that conversation, Ellen said that she had something that she'd like to share with me about herself. And then she started to tell me about her history. So that's really how it began.
Ellen, let me ask you about that same thing. When you sat then or sit now with people, of course, now it's very public, but for years it's been kind of a matter of choice for you, just how far you came out on this front with people. What goes on in your mind when you would try and decide?
I'll say first, I never have disclosed to anyone so quickly as I did to Steve. I could just sense the kindness and gentleness and intelligence and caring nature that he had, which made me trust him immediately and tell him almost immediately. For most people, it takes a long time. And I have had some friends for years who I never even told until the book was about to come out for a variety of reasons, either because I felt like they they had prejudiced views or that it would worry them or various other reasons. Mm-hmm. But, I was, as you say, mostly closeted for many, many years. And that's a kind of painful place to be in. It's terrible having a big secret. So that's one good thing I like about having done the book.
May I ask you about the telling? Because in some ways, whether you would articulate this to someone or not, your behavior, as you describe it in the book, was often in itself telling. I mean, did you not have people sort of, scratch their head and look at you and say, whoa, after some incident was public, not just private?
Well, actually, the truth is, even while I think that my thoughts – I have a special premium on the truth and what I believe is true, even though other people don't believe it, I recognize that other people will think it's crazy. And I'm motivated not to appear crazy, so I don't say it if I can. And if I can't not say it, I stay home. Or I say it in my analysis, or I say it to Steve or my husband.
So voices are bugging you, or fantasies are bugging you. You'll sort of pull the curtain and deal with it yourself.
Right, except for, I guess, the breakdown in the roof of the Yale Law School. That was just totally – I was totally out of control.
Stephen?
But for the most part, I can hide it, except from people like Stephen, my husband, Will.
Right. I'll ask about Will, but Stephen, just on your front, what has it been like over all these years to be a confidant of someone wrestling with these, you know, special demons?
Well, I really think about Ellen as a very dear friend, and I don't... I mean, it's odd that you ask the question in that way because it feels so far removed from my experience of our friendship.
It's all just sweetness and light. I mean, I've known schizophrenics very closely, and, you know, and family members of very close friends, and for all their love, I saw some pretty difficult passes. Maybe yours is different.
Well, I think that Ellen certainly has had some very difficult passes, and I think that this is an illness that, in some respects, has reached to the core of Ellen, if that I think is a way of capturing it. And we have been through some very challenging times together, but it's the sort of thing that I think one does for a dear friend. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that as I have been there for Ellen at some very challenging times in her life, she has been very present for me at some very challenging times in mine. Mm-hmm. So I have tried, when life has been difficult for Ellen, to be there as a good listener and as a good support, but primarily as a good friend.
Let's take a call from Spokane, Washington, if I may. Zach is on the line from Spokane. Hi, Zach. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Sachs and Steve. I wanted to, if I could, ask for some advice from Dr. Sachs. I have a really close friend that's actually part of my Bible study group, mm-hmm. and in the past year and a half, he has really started to exhibit some of the symptoms that you would, I guess, normally see with schizophrenia. However, he really has had some bad experiences with mental health treatment in the past, and is extremely resistant to any kind of suggestion that he seek any kind of help. There's no one professionally in our group that really can provide that, and we're really at a loss as to what to do to try to help him get his life moving forward again. And other than just you know, being there for him and listening and trying to show him love, I just wanted to know if she has any advice for us.
Zach, we're going to get that answer after a break. Let me just flesh it out a little bit because the break's right in front of us here. What makes you think that it may be in this category of problems, schizophrenia? I mean, are you a professional of some kind, or do you see delusion here, something that looks to you beyond depression? Why do you think it may fall in this realm?
Well, because of the delusion is one of the things, a lot of the things that Dr. Sachs described, and if you read about schizophrenia, just, you know, folks that just they think they hear messages from things, hear voices, hear sounds, think that things are happening that are just not happening, sometimes right there when you're sitting with them, and just have ideas about what's going on around them that is just you know, obviously not in the realm of reality.
We're talking this hour about a life of schizophrenia, an extraordinary life. Ellen Sachs, a top-flight law professor at University of Southern California, also schizophrenic. She's sharing a look into her life and mine, looking with us at what she calls her journey through madness. Her new memoir is just that. The Center Cannot Hold, My Journey Through Madness. Stephen Behnke is with us as well. He's teaches in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. They went to law school together in New Haven, Yale Law School, some years back. Let me ask each of you about Zach's question. You heard he's in Spokane, Washington. He's got a friend in his study group, Bible study group, who he and his friends are worried about. He asked what to do. Ellen, first to you. You've been on the suffering side of this.
That's right.
What do you recommend?
I guess I would say first that probably we should listen to Steve on this as much as or more than we should listen to me, because he's been the friend and I've been the patient. The second thing I'd like to say is that, you know, this is a really, really tough situation, and it happens not infrequently, and mm-hmm. people feel very helpless and don't know what to do. And it's also the case that if I knew the answer, you know, I would be the second schizophrenic with a Nobel, because that's one of the hardest nuts to crack in psychiatry. For me,
it's so hard to figure out how friends can interact with the problem to help. Is that what you're saying?
Hard to figure out how we can get people to want treatment, to comply with treatment without forcing them. Mm-hmm. And part of that would be friends talking to them. For me, when I'm feeling unwell, it helps for people to be comforting and supportive, not challenging what I'm thinking, but saying, oh, God, you feel that. That someone's trying to get you. That must be very scary. I think maybe you're having symptoms of your illness, and let's go talk to your doctor. You'll feel better. Other people just get furious if you say that. So I don't really know this person. One thing I would say, Zach talked about the person having bad experiences with mental health treatment, and I'm wondering if he had forced or coerced treatment in the past, and if so, his story is the reason why we should try to figure out ways to get people to comply voluntarily, because they resist treatment in the future if they've had unpleasant or bad treatment in the past.
Right. That raises a couple of issues that we'll come to, but first, just the straight-ahead question, Stephen Behnke, of here's Zach. He's worried that his friend has mental health issues right down this alley, right down this line, and he doesn't know how to help him. What do you suggest?
Well, it's just such a difficult situation to be in, and it really depends on the person. I think to be a good friend or a family member, one of the things that you're going to have to do is to be able to sit with a lot of anxiety.
Right.
I would say, I would ask Zach a number of questions, starting with how well do you know this person? In the 23 years that Ellen and I have known one another, I think I have, on two occasions, picked up the phone and called one of Ellen's treaters because I felt the situation was serious enough that they really needed to know what was going on. But in every other instance, I have always simply said to Ellen, how can I be helpful to you? What should I do? And I have taken Ellen's lead on that. So it's a tough situation, and it really depends on the person who is your friend or your family member.
But someone who's suffering this can't always give you the best advice on what you should do as a friend, right? I mean, they may not be – that may be by, sort of by definition part of the problem. Ellen describes a situation when you and she were in law school. A professor noticed that she seemed really troubled, invited her over for dinner. Things went badly. By the end of that night, you know, she's in the hospital sort of – up against the wall in restraint. He was trying to help her. It ended up in a way that she found painful.
Well, that's right, Tom, and that's why I think that's why on those two occasions within the context of those 23 years, I felt that Ellen's judgment was sufficiently compromised that I needed to do something regardless of her wishes. I was not comfortable on either occasion. I would do that again.
Psychologist and an attorney, so nobody should know better than you exactly what your options are.
Steve, well, do you remember?
Ellen, yeah.
Do you remember our most troubling situation was when I thought that you and my analyst, Dr. Kaplan, were taken over by aliens. So I would just hang up when you would call and wouldn't talk to you because it wasn't you. Now, that must have been a challenge.
Well, it was terrible because Ellen and I speak on a very regular basis, and I had not heard from Ellen for 2 or 3 days. She had been actually traveling to a conference in San Francisco. So I knew that something was wrong, and I started to call on a much more frequent basis, still was not hearing back. And then Will, Ellen's husband, left me a message saying something is very wrong. But that's a wonderful example because at that moment, Ellen thought that both I and her treating psychoanalyst had been occupied by aliens. So it really, we were both in the same situation at that moment. So who does one call in a moment
right.
like that? Simply not easy answers to any of these things.
Not easy even after, Ellen, in your case, this is something you've been aware of and working with for many, many years. So it's not
right.
It's not like Zach sounds fairly young. His friend, this may be a tiger just coming out of the cage. I don't know if that's the right kind of metaphor at all, but this may be a new difficulty for his friend to face.
all the more difficult to know what to do in that case.
Right.
Yeah, I think if I could just say here, and Ellen, tell me what you think about this. I think that Ellen's book, The Center Cannot Hold, is this story of Ellen coming to know her illness. And I think that is hugely important. One has to get to know one's own way of being psychotic. It's also the story of Ellen's friends getting to know Ellen's illness and Ellen's treaters getting to know one's illness. So it's a story of relationships on multiple levels. And Zach, you haven't said your age, but from the sound of your voice, I am guessing that you're younger than Ellen and myself. So you really and your friend really may be at the beginning of that process.
Ellen, let me ask you about your marriage. You write about your husband Will, and of course this is somebody who you're going to spend a lot of time with. You write about the first major experience that he had of you as wildly delusional. Within that kind of intimate relationship, how does schizophrenia sit? How have you and he come to terms with it?
I guess, you know, I didn't tell him for a while, but because I
before or
feel,
after your marriage?
Before.
Good.
Yeah. But when I sat down and told him, unlike most people who say, I would never have guessed in a million years, including mental health professionals, he said, you know, I kind of had a hunch. And either he knew me better, or he felt more free to express what he thought. I'm not really sure. Or he's very intuitive and empathic. But he kind of knew. And he received the news as best as anyone could, very calm, kind, ask questions but not too intrusive. And like Steve, he is very attuned to how I'm doing, so that he, like Steve, can even know that I'm starting to slip before I do. He says there's a particular kind of silence that I do. It's not just any silence, but a particular kind, and that's really a gift. And when he first actually saw me psychotic, again, he was scared, he was upset, but he didn't flee. He was kind. He called Steve. I guess he's only seen me psychotic twice, then and when I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Well, half a dozen
but,
years ago.
You know, he's been great. Yeah. Yeah,
so
he's been great.
That slipping you're talking about, is it that rare at this point? And what do you mean by slipping?
Yeah. Well, I mean starting to have symptoms.
Between medication and talk therapy, those are...
I still have symptoms sometimes.
How frequently?
You know, I have what I talked about earlier, very transient thoughts very frequently, you know, a couple of times daily. You know, 2 or 3 days of symptoms. You know, we had some guests and I was out of my office. I get a lot of comfort from my routine and I had a few days of disarray. I guess the last time I was sick for more than a week was in 2001. I mean, I'm on a drug now, which is really incredible. It doesn't completely stop me having symptoms, but it makes them farther apart and less intense and less long-lasting. And
I want to ask about the medication, but we have a lot of listeners who want to speak with you as well. Let's go to Richard in Charleston, South Carolina. Richard, you're on the air with Ellen Sachs and Stephen Behnke.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have schizoaffective disorder. I've been living with it for about 10 years. I'm an undergrad trying to get a bachelor's in psychology. I was hoping to focus on how to get through school. I know a lot of other people with this illness have a really rough time just getting through, you know, the day-to-day. And also, I was wondering if you think of a book. I think that anyone of us could write a book on their lives. Do you think it's a bit exploitive on the social stigma of schizophrenia, or is it helping?
Richard, the phone line is dropping a little bit.
Part.
I think I got, first of all, you know, tips on how to get through school. He's dealing with it. How do you make it through, in his case, a college education? And secondly, the stigma concern. You know, you've put it all right there in the book. Are you not worried about the stigma? Perhaps Richard is, and I'm sorry your phone line is rough, Richard. But what do you say, Ellen?
I guess, you know, getting through school, I mean, I guess each person has to find his or her own way of what they need to do to enable themselves to work. I mean, one thing I did when I was – and I still do, but when I was tenure track particularly is I worked really hard because I knew there would be some downtimes. So I kind of built that into my schedule. The second thing for me, work is kind of the last thing that goes and the thing that really holds me together. So it wasn't a challenge to work because it was the kind of thing that I naturally gravitated toward and loved doing.
But can you imagine? I mean, it sounds as though for Richard, you know, there are issues here. He's trying to get through school, and it's not easy. Right. I mean, right. you mentioned your medication. Presumably, right. for any diagnosed schizophrenic, getting that right is huge.
Right. I think, you know, it's very important, in addition to, you know, little things like building downtime into your schedule, mm-hmm. that you have a good support system, again, people who know the illness in general and your illness in particular, and people you can trust and depend on, as well as very good therapists, and as well as getting your medication right. And then a lot of it is just, you know, luck, hard work and luck. Mm-hmm. And the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, the stigma is...
Yes, please.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask on the medication. We'll come to stigma. One thing in friends of mine who have struggled on this front, the struggle with medication, and you write about the same thing in your book, is so big because I always felt they feared a kind of loss of self, even though their self was so troubled it was hard to live with. But the
right.
medication is kind of a blanket or a, you know, analgesic that took away their selfhood, even as
right.
it helped them.
Right.
Has that been an issue?
That's not been my experience losing mm-hmm. myself. I certainly went like 10 or 15 years trying repeatedly to get off medication. I think I did that because of the blow to my self-esteem. I didn't want to think I had a mental illness. I was in denial, and I could prove that I didn't by getting off medication. Mm-hmm. And so I would try and try and try. Always failed. A couple of things happened that made me think that I should try staying on medication, and I have. I think – in addition to loss of self, one of the things people say is they don't want to use a crutch. But what I've come to think is that, you know, if my foot were broken, I would gladly use a crutch. Well, my neurotransmitters are broken. Don't I want to treat them at least as gently?
Mm.
So I'm a big proponent of medication, although I'm also a big proponent of patient choice, that if a patient has the capacity to make the decision, they should be permitted to, even if their choice is unwise.
Mm. Let's go to Kate in Hartford, Vermont. Kate, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I was diagnosed with this illness when I was about, 21.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had no symptoms since I was about 24, but I have never in my life heard it discussed in the way you are discussing it today. And I'm highly functioning. I work as a planner, an urban planner, but have background in architecture and engineering, so I sort of understand the whole field. And
Kate, what do you mean about the way it's being discussed here? Are you happy to hear it openly discussed or not? Or
yes, I'm happy to hear from someone who is highly functioning and also incredibly intelligent discuss a mental illness of this. I mean, the popular culture, it hit my self-esteem so hard when I when I went to see my doctor for the first time, and you know I had this problem, and I didn't know that there were other people out there that could live normal lives and still suffer from something that's so. I mean, my impression of it is that it is like just the most horrible, like. Taboo. You don't talk about it, and it's...
Right.
Ellen, you've put it out there. The stigma issue comes up again. Are we getting past it or not, or is it just intrinsic to humans to see a stigma here?
I mean, stigma is a difficult problem, and I think there are a variety of reasons why there's stigma with mental illness, one being just marginalizing deviant people, another being that people may think people with mental illness are to blame, and it's okay to criticize people at blame. They may feel guilty, even though I don't think, you know, childhood events cause schizophrenia. They also may be a little frightened, like, you know, I have some of that stuff in me, so they want to make the person other and distant. And of course, stigma is really terrible for sufferers. It makes them feel much worse about themselves, much more ashamed. And it, you know, the bad thing is, given stigma, a lot of people are discouraged from seeking treatment, and I think not getting treatment that could, you know, really help one is a real shame. And what can we do about it? Well, more people coming forward. Easy for me to say with tenure and so on,
mm-hmm.
But also you know, a more responsible media. I think the media highlights crimes by people with schizophrenia. If people with schizophrenia commit crimes, they should at least be contextualized in terms of our knowledge that people with schizophrenia are generally not more dangerous, and that the press should also publicize, I think, you know, good things and accomplishments of people with schizophrenia. And then also, you know, again, putting resources into the system. If people are helped to live up to their pre-illness potential and people in the public see people doing that, mm-hmm. you know, the stigma will also decline. So I think the stigma mm-hmm. piece is really, really important. And it's getting better, I think, you know, with eating disorders and depression and bipolar, and schizophrenia mm-hmm. is one of the last, you know, bastions of prejudice, I think.
We've only got a minute here or less. When I hear someone like Kate call, and Kate, I'm so grateful for your call. I mean, I just want to hear you, Ellen, give your advice to those who are in your situation, Kate's situation, those who are wrestling with this, your sort of bottom line advice, because surely it's worth sharing.
I guess, you know, learn about your illness in general and learn how it affects you in particular. You know, surround yourself with good friends, find an accommodating work environment, and hope that you have a lot of good luck, too, because I think that's so important. And I think, you know, try to get the help you need, because with help, people with schizophrenia needn't be condemned to a sentence to a bleak and painful life. That's just stigma itself speaking. Mm-hmm.
Ellen Sachs, that's huge advice right there. The new memoir is The Center Cannot Hold. Stephen Behnke in Washington, thank you for joining us. And Ellen Sachs, thank you so much for being so public on a tough issue. We're grateful. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.